suggests an extreme rationalization, but as we shall see in the final chapter, the brain abhors discrepancies of any kind, and an absurdly far-fetched delusion is sometimes the only way out. The advantage of our neurological theory over the Freudian view is that it can be tested experimentally. As we saw earlier, when you look at something that's emotionally evocative, a tiger, your lover, or indeed your mother, your amygdala signals your hypothalamus to prepare your body for action. This fight-or-flight reaction is not all or nothing. It operates on a continuum. A mildly, moderate, or profoundly emotional experience elicits a mild, moderate, or profound autonomic reaction, respectively. And part of these continuous autonomic reactions to experience is microsweating. Your whole body, including your palms, becomes damper or drier in proportion to any upticks or downticks in your level of emotional arousal at any given moment. This is good news for us scientists because it means we can measure your emotional reaction to the things you see by simply monitoring the degree of your microsweating. This can be done simply by taping two passive electrodes to your skin and routing them through a device called an ohmmeter to monitor your galvanic skin response, GSR, the moment-to-moment fluctuations in the electrical resistance of your skin. GSR is also called the skin conductance response, or SCR. Thus, when you see a foxy pinup or a gruesome medical picture, your body sweats, your skin resistance drops, and you get a big GSR. On the other hand, if you see something completely neutral, like a doorknob or an unfamiliar face, you get no GSR, although the doorknob may very well produce a GSR in a Freudian psychoanalyst. Now, you may well wonder why we should go through the elaborate process of measuring GSR to monitor emotional arousal. Why not simply ask people how something made them feel? The answer is that between the stage of emotional reaction and the verbal report, there are many complex layers of processing, so what you often get is an intellectualized or censored story. For instance, if a subject is a closet homosexual, he may in fact deny his arousal when he sees a Chippendales dancer, but his GSR can't lie because he has no control over it. GSR is one of the physiological signals that is used in polygraph or so-called lie detector tests. It is a foolproof test to see if emotions are genuine as opposed to verbally faked. And believe it or not, all normal people get huge GSR jolts when they are shown a picture of their mothers. They don't even have to be Jewish. Based on this reasoning, we measured David's GSR. When we flashed neutral pictures of things like a table and chairs, there was no GSR. Nor did his GSR change when he was shown unfamiliar faces, since there was no jolt of familiarity. So far, nothing unusual. But when we showed him his mother's picture, there was no GSR either. This never occurs in normal people. This observation provides striking confirmation of our theory. But if this is true, why doesn't David call, say, his mailman an imposter, assuming he used to know his mailman prior to the accident? After all, the disconnection between vision and emotion should apply equally to the mailman, not just his mother. Shouldn't this lead to the same symptom? The answer is that his brain doesn't expect an emotional jolt when he sees the mailman. Your mother is your life. Your mail carrier is just some person. Another paradox was that David did not have the imposter delusion when his mother spoke to him on the phone from the adjacent room. "Oh, Mom, it's so good to hear from you. How are you?" he would say. How does my theory account for this? How can someone be delusional about his mother when she shows up in person, but not when she phones him? There is, in fact, an elegantly simple explanation. It turns out that there is a separate anatomical pathway from the hearing centers of the brain, the auditory cortex, to your amygdala. This pathway was not destroyed in David, so his mother's voice evoked the strong positive emotions he expected to feel. This time, there was no need for delusion. Soon after our findings on David were published in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society of London, I received a letter from a patient named Mr. Turner, who lived in Georgia. He claimed to have developed Capgras syndrome after a head injury. He liked my theory, he said, because he now understood he wasn't crazy or losing his mind. There was a perfectly logical explanation for his strange symptoms, which he would now try to overcome if he could. But he then went on to add that what troubled him most was not the imposter illusion, but the fact that he no longer enjoyed visual scenes, such as beautiful landscapes and flower gardens, which had been immensely pleasing prior to the accident. Nor did he enjoy great works of art, like he used to. His knowledge that this was caused by the disconnection in his brain did not restore the appeal of flowers or art. This made me wonder whether these connections might play a role in all of us when we enjoy art. Can we study these connections to explore the neural basis of our aesthetic response to beauty? I'll return to this question when we discuss the neurology of art in chapters 7 and 8. One last twist to this strange tale. It was late at night and I was in bed when the phone rang. I woke up and looked at the clock. It was 4 a.m. It was an attorney. He was calling me from London and had apparently overlooked the time difference.
"Is this Dr. Ramachandran?"
"Yes, it is," I mumbled, still half asleep.
"I am Mr. Watson. We have a case we would like your opinion on. Perhaps you could fly over and examine the patient?"
"What's this all about?" I said, trying not to sound irritated.
"My client, Mr. Dobbs, was in a car accident," he said. "He was unconscious for several days. When he came out of it, he was quite normal, except for a slight difficulty finding the right word when he talks."
"Well, I'm happy to hear that," I said. "Some slight word-finding difficulty is extremely common after brain injury, no matter where the injury is." There was a pause. So I asked, "What can I do for you?"
"Mr. Dobbs, Jonathan, wants to file a lawsuit against the people whose car collided with his. This fault was clearly the other party's, so their insurance company is going to compensate Jonathan financially for the damage to his car. But the legal system is very conservative here in England. The physicians here have found him to be physically normal. His MRI is normal, and there are no neurological symptoms or other injuries anywhere in his body. So the insurance company will only pay for the car damage, not for any health-related issues."
"Well?"
"The problem, Dr. Ramachandran, is that he claims to have developed the Capgras syndrome. Even though he knows that he is looking at his wife, she often seems like a stranger, a new person. This is extremely troubling to him, and he wants to sue the other party for $1 million for having caused a permanent neuropsychiatric disturbance."
"Pray, continue."
"Soon after the accident, someone found your book, Phantoms in the Brain, lying on my client's coffee table. He admitted to reading it, which is when he realized he might have the Capgras syndrome. But this bit of self-diagnosis didn't help him in any way. The symptoms remained just the same. So he and I want to sue the other party for $1 million for having produced this permanent neurological symptom. He fears he may even end up divorcing his wife. The trouble is, Dr. Ramachandran, the other attorney is claiming that my client has simply fabricated the whole thing after reading your book. Because, if you think about it, it's very easy to fake the Capgras syndrome. Mr. Dobbs and I would like to fly you out to London so you can administer the GSR test and prove to the court that he does indeed have the Capgras syndrome, that he isn't malingering. I understand you cannot fake this test."
The attorney had done his homework, but I had no intention of flying to London just to administer this test.
"Mr. Watson, what's the problem? If Mr. Dobbs finds that his wife looks like a new woman every time he sees her, he should find her perpetually attractive. This is a good thing. Not bad at all. We should all be so lucky."
My only excuse for this tasteless joke is that I was still only barely awake. There was a long pause at the other end, and a click as he hung up on me. I never heard from him again. My sense of humor is not always well received. Even though my remark may have sounded frivolous,
it wasn't entirely off the mark. There's a well-known psychological phenomenon called the Coolidge effect, named after President Calvin Coolidge. It's based on a little-known experiment performed by rat psychologists decades ago. Start with a sex-deprived male rat in a cage. Put a female rat in the cage. The male mounts the female, consummating the relationship several times until he collapses from sheer sexual exhaustion, or so it would seem. The fun begins if you now introduce a new female into the cage. He gets going again and performs several times until he is once again thoroughly exhausted. Now introduce a third new female rat, and our apparently exhausted male rat starts all over again. This voyeuristic experiment is a striking demonstration of the potent effect of novelty on sexual attraction and performance. I have often wondered whether the effect is also true for female rats courting males, but to my knowledge, that hasn't been tried, probably because for many years, most psychologists were men. The story is told that President Coolidge and his wife were on a state visit to Oklahoma, and they were invited to a chicken coop, apparently one of their major tourist attractions. The president had to first give a speech, but since Mrs. Coolidge had already heard the speech many times, she decided to go to the coop an hour earlier. She was being shown around by the farmer. She was surprised to see that the coop had dozens of hens, but only one majestic rooster. When she asked the guide about this, he replied, "Well, he is a fine rooster. He goes on and on all night and day, servicing the hens."
"All night?" said Mrs. Coolidge. "Will you do me a big favor? When the president gets here, tell him in exactly the same words what you just told me."
An hour later, when the president showed up, the farmer repeated the story. The president asked,
"Tell me something. Does the rooster go on all night with the same hen, or different hens?"
"Why, different hens, of course," replied the farmer.
"Well, do me a favor," said the president. "Tell the first lady what you just told me."
This story may be apocryphal, but it does raise a fascinating question. Would a patient with Capgras syndrome never get bored with his wife? Would she remain perpetually novel and attractive? If the syndrome could somehow be evoked temporarily with transcranial magnetic stimulation, one could make a fortune. Chapter 3. Loud Colors and Hot Babes. Synesthesia.
My life is spent in one long effort to escape from the commonplaces of existence. These little problems help me to do so.
Sherlock Holmes. Whenever Francesca closes her eyes and touches a particular texture, she experiences a vivid emotion. Denim, extreme sadness. Silk, peace and calm. Orange peel, shock. Wax, embarrassment. She sometimes feels subtle nuances of emotions. Grade 60 sandpaper produces guilt, and grade 120 evokes the feeling of telling a white lie. Mirabelle, on the other hand, experiences colors every time she sees numbers, even though they are typed in black ink. When recalling a phone number, she conjures up a spectrum of the colors corresponding to the numbers in her mind's eye and proceeds to read off the numbers one by one, deducing them from the colors. This makes it easy to memorize phone numbers. When Esmeralda hears a C sharp played on the piano, she sees blue. Other notes evoke other distinct colors, so much so that different piano keys are actually color-coded for her, making it easier to remember and play musical scales. These women are not crazy, nor are they suffering from a neurological disorder. They and millions of otherwise normal people have synesthesia, a surreal blending of sensation, perception, and emotion. Synesthetes, as such people are called, experience the ordinary world in extraordinary ways, seeming to inhabit a strange no-man's land between reality and fantasy. They taste colors, see sounds, hear shapes, or touch emotions in myriad combinations. When my lab colleagues and I first came across synesthesia in 1997, we didn't know what to make of it. But in the years since, it has proven to be an unexpected key for unlocking the mysteries of what makes us distinctly human. It turns out this little quirky phenomenon not only sheds light on normal sensory processing, but it takes us on a meandering path to confront some of the most intriguing aspects of our minds, such as abstract thinking and metaphor. It may illuminate attributes of human brain architecture and genetics that might underlie important aspects of creativity and imagination. When I embarked on this journey nearly 12 years ago, I had four goals in mind. First, to show that synesthesia is real. These people aren't just making it up. Second, to propose a theory of exactly what is going on in their brains that sets them apart from non-synesthetes. Third, to explore the genetics of the condition. And fourth, and most important, to explore the possibility that, far from being a mere curiosity, synesthesia may give us valuable clues to understanding some of the most mysterious aspects of the human mind. Abilities such as language, creativity, and abstract thought that come to us so effortlessly that we take them for granted. Finally, as an additional bonus, synesthesia may also shed light on age-old philosophical questions of qualia, the ineffable raw qualities of experience, and consciousness. Overall, I am happy with the way our research has proceeded since then. We have come up with partial answers to all four questions. More important, we have galvanized an unprecedented interest in this phenomenon. There is now virtually a synesthesia industry, with over a dozen books published on the topic.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
We don't know when synesthesia was first recognized as a human trait, but there are hints that Isaac Newton could have experienced it. Aware that the pitch of a sound depends on its wavelength, Newton invented a toy, a musical keyboard, that flashed up different colors on a screen for different notes. Thus, every song was accompanied by a kaleidoscopic display of colors. One wonders if sound color synesthesia inspired his invention. Could a mixing of senses in his brain have provided the original impetus for his wavelength theory of color? Newton proved that white light is composed of a mixture of colors which can be separated by a prism, with each color corresponding to a particular wavelength of light. Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin and one of the most colorful and eccentric scientists of the Victorian era, conducted the first systematic study of synesthesia in the 1890s. Galton made many valuable contributions to psychology, especially the measurement of intelligence. Unfortunately, he was also an extreme racist. He helped usher in the pseudoscience of eugenics, whose goal was to improve mankind by selective breeding of the kind practiced with domesticated livestock. Galton was convinced that the poor were poor because of inferior genes and that they must be forbidden from breeding too much, lest they overwhelm and contaminate the gene pool of the landed gentry and rich folk like him. It isn't clear why an otherwise intelligent man should hold such views, but my hunch is that he had an unconscious need to attribute his own fame and success to innate genius rather than acknowledging the role of opportunity and circumstance. Ironically, he himself was childless. Galton's ideas about eugenics seem almost comical in hindsight, yet there is no denying his genius. In 1892, Galton published a short article on synesthesia in the journal Nature. This was one of his lesser-known papers, but about a century later, it piqued my interest. Although Galton wasn't the first to notice the phenomenon, he was the first to document it systematically and encourage people to explore it further. His paper focused on the two most common types of synesthesia, the kind in which sounds evoke colors, auditory visual synesthesia, and the kind in which printed numbers always seem tinged with inherent color, grapheme color synesthesia. He pointed out that even though a specific number always produces the same color for any given synesthete, the number color associations are different for different synesthetes. In other words, it's not as though all synesthetes see a 5 as red or a 6 as green. To Mary, 5 always looks blue, 6 is magenta, and 7 is chartreuse. To Susan, 5 is vermilion, 6 is light green, and 4 is yellow. How to explain these people's experiences? Are they crazy? Do they simply have vivid associations from childhood memories? Are they just speaking poetically? When scientists encounter anomalous oddities, such as synesthetes, their initial reaction is usually to brush them under the carpet and ignore them. This attitude, which many of my colleagues are very vulnerable to, is not as silly as it seems. Because a majority of anomalies, spoon bending, alien abduction, Elvis sightings, turn out to be false alarms, it's not a bad idea for a scientist to play it safe and ignore them. Whole careers, even lifetimes, have been wasted on the pursuit of oddities such as polywater, a hypothetical form of water based on crackpot science, telepathy, or cold fusion. So I wasn't surprised that even though we had known about synesthesia for over a century, it has generally been sidelined as a curiosity because it didn't make sense. Even now, the phenomenon is often dismissed as bogus. When I bring it up in casual conversation, I often hear it shot down on the spot. I've heard, "So you study acid junkies?" and "Whoa, cuckoo!" and a dozen other dismissals. Unfortunately, even physicians are not immune, and ignorance in a physician can be quite hazardous to people's health. I know of at least one case in which a synesthete was misdiagnosed as having schizophrenia and was prescribed antipsychotic medication to rid her of hallucinations. Fortunately, her parents took it upon themselves to get informed, and in the course of their reading came across an article on synesthesia. They drew this to the doctor's attention, and their daughter was quickly taken off the drugs. Synesthesia as a real phenomenon did have a few supporters, including the neurologist Dr. Richard Cytoic, who wrote two books about it, Synesthesia, A Union of the Senses, 1989, and The Man Who Tasted Shapes, 1993-2003. Cytoic was a pioneer, but he was a prophet preaching in the wilderness and was largely ignored by the establishment. It didn't help matters that the theories he put forward to explain synesthesia were a bit vague. He suggested that the phenomenon was a kind of evolutionary throwback to a more primitive brain state in which the senses hadn't quite separated and were being mingled in the emotional core of the brain. This idea of an undifferentiated primitive brain didn't make sense to me. If the synesthete's brain was reverting to an earlier state, then how would you explain the distinctive and specific nature of the synesthete's experiences? Why, for example, does Esmeralda see C-sharp as being invariably blue? If Cytoic was correct, you would expect the senses to just blend into each other to create a blurry mess. A second explanation that is sometimes posed is that synesthetes are just remembering childhood memories and associations. Maybe they played with refrigerator magnets, and the 5 was red, and the 6 was green. Maybe they remember this association vividly, just as you might recall the smell of a rose, the taste of Marmite or curry, or the trill of a robin in the spring. Of course, this theory doesn't explain why only some people remain stuck with such vivid sensory memories. I certainly don't see colors when looking at numbers or listening to tones, and I doubt whether you do either. While I might think of cold when I look at a picture of an ice cube, I certainly don't feel it, no matter how many childhood experiences I may have had with ice and snow. I might say that I feel warm and fuzzy when stroking a cat, but I would never say touching metal makes me feel jealous. A third hypothesis is that synesthetes are using vague tangential speech or metaphors when they speak of C major being red or chicken tasting pointy,
just as you and I speak of a loud shirt or sharp cheddar cheese. Cheese is, after all, soft to touch, so what do you mean when you say it is sharp? Sharp and dull are tactile adjectives, so why do you apply them without hesitation to the taste of cheese? Our ordinary language is replete with synesthetic metaphors. Hot babe, flat taste, tastefully dressed. So maybe synesthetes are just especially gifted in this regard. But there is a serious problem with this explanation. We don't have the foggiest idea of how metaphors work or how they are represented in the brain. The notion that synesthesia is just metaphor illustrates one of the classic pitfalls in science, trying to explain one mystery, synesthesia, in terms of another, metaphor. What I propose instead is to turn the problem on its head and suggest the very opposite. I suggest that synesthesia is a concrete sensory process whose neural basis we can uncover, and that the explanation might in turn provide clues for solving the deeper question of how metaphors are represented in the brain and how we evolved the capacity to entertain them in the first place. This doesn't imply that metaphor is just a form of synesthesia, only that understanding the neural basis of the latter can help illuminate the former. So when I resolved to do my own investigation of synesthesia, my first goal was to establish whether it was a genuine sensory experience. In 1997, a doctoral student in my lab, Ed Hubbard, and I set out to find some synesthetes to begin our investigations. But how? According to most published surveys, the incidence was anywhere from 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 10,000. That fall, I was lecturing to an undergraduate class of 300 students. Maybe we'd get lucky. So we made an announcement. Certain otherwise normal people claim they see sounds, or that certain numbers always evoke certain colors, we told the class. If any one of you experiences this, please raise your hands. To our disappointment, not a single hand went up. But later that day, as I was chatting with Ed in my office, two students knocked on the door. One of them, Susan, had striking blue eyes, streaks of red dye in her blonde ringlets, a silver ring in her belly button, and an enormous skateboard. She said to us, "I'm one of those people you talked about in class, Dr. Ramachandran. I didn't raise my hand because I didn't want people to think I was weird or something. I didn't even know that there were others like me, or that the condition had a name." Ed and I looked at each other, pleasantly surprised. We asked the other student to come back later and waved Susan into a chair. She leaned the skateboard against the wall and sat down. "How long have you experienced this?" I asked. "Oh, from early childhood. But I didn't really pay much attention to it at that time, I suppose. But then it gradually dawned on me that it was really odd, and I didn't discuss it with anyone. I didn't want people thinking I was crazy or something. Until you mentioned it in class, I didn't know that it had a name. What did you call it? Something that rhymes with anesthesia?" "It's called synesthesia," I said. "Susan, I want you to describe your experiences to me in detail. Our lab has a special interest in it. What exactly do you experience?"
"When I see certain numbers, I always see specific colors. The number 5 is always a specific shade of dull red. 3 is blue. 7 is bright blood red. 8 is yellow. And 9 is chartreuse."
I grabbed a felt pen and pad that were on the table and drew a big 7. "What do you see?"
"Well, it's not a very clean 7, but it looks red. I told you that."
"Now, I want you to think carefully before you answer this question. Do you actually see the red? Or does it just make you think of red, or make you visualize red, like a memory image? For example, when I hear the word Cinderella, I think of a young girl, or of pumpkins, or coaches. Is it like that? Or do you literally see the color?"
"That's a tough one. It's something I have often asked myself. I guess I do really see it. That number you drew looks distinctly red to me, but I can also see that it's really black. Or I should say, I know it's black. So in some sense, it is a memory image of sorts. I must be seeing it in my mind's eye or something. But it certainly doesn't feel like that. It feels like I am actually seeing it. It's very hard to describe, Doctor.
You are doing very well, Susan. You are a good observer, and that makes everything you say valuable.
Well, one thing I can tell you for sure is that it isn't like imagining a pumpkin when looking at a picture of Cinderella or listening to the word Cinderella. I do actually see the color.
One of the first things we teach medical students is to listen to the patient by taking a careful history. 90% of the time, you can arrive at an uncannily accurate diagnosis by paying close attention, using physical examination and sophisticated lab tests to confirm your hunch and to increase the bill to the insurance company. I started to wonder whether this dictum might be true not just for patients, but for synesthetes as well. I decided to give Susan some simple tests and questions. For example, was it the actual visual appearance of the numeral that evoked the color, or was it the numerical concept, the idea of sequence, or even of quantity? If the latter, then would Roman numerals do the trick, or only Arabic ones? I should call them Indian numerals, really. They were invented in India in the first millennium BCE and exported to Europe via Arabs. I drew a big Roman numeral 7 on the pad and showed it to her. What do you see?
I see it's a 7, but it looks black. No trace of red. I've always known that. Roman numerals don't work.
Hey, doctor, doesn't that prove it can't be a memory thing? Because I do know it's a 7, but it still doesn't generate the red.
Ed and I realized that we were dealing with a very bright student. It was starting to look like synesthesia was indeed a genuine sensory phenomenon brought on by the actual visual appearance of the numeral, not by the numerical concept. But this was still well short of proof. Could we be absolutely sure that this wasn't happening because early in kindergarten she had repeatedly seen a red 7 on her refrigerator door? I wondered what would happen if I showed her black-and-white half-tone photos of fruits and vegetables, which, for most of us, have strong memory color associations. I drew pictures of a carrot, a tomato, a pumpkin, and a banana, and showed them to her.
What do you see?
Well, I don't see any colors, if that's what you're asking. I know the carrot is orange, and can imagine it to be so, or visualize it to be orange. But I don't actually see the orange color the way I see red when you show me the 7. It's hard to explain, doctor, but it's like this. When I see the black and white carrot, I kind of know it's orange, but I can visualize it as being any bizarre color I want, like a blue carrot. It's very hard for me to do that with 7. It keeps screaming red at me. Is all of this making any sense to you guys?
Okay, I told her. Now I want you to close your eyes and show me your hands. She seemed slightly startled by my request, but followed my instructions. I then drew the numeral 7 on the palm of her hand. What did I draw? Here, let me do it again.
It's a 7.
Is it colored?
No, absolutely not. Well, let me rephrase that. I don't initially see red, even though I feel it's 7. But then I start visualizing the 7, and it's sort of tinged red.
Okay, Susan, what if I say 7?
Here, let's try it. 7, 7, 7. It wasn't red initially, but then I started to experience red. Once I start visualizing the appearance of the shape of 7, then I see the red, but not before that.
On a whim, I said, 7, 5, 3, 2, 8.
What did you see then, Susan?
My God, that's very interesting. I see a rainbow.
What do you mean?
Well, I see the corresponding colors spread out in front of me as in a rainbow, with the colors matching the number sequence you read aloud. It's a very pretty rainbow.
One more question, Susan. Here is that drawing of 7 again. Do you see the color directly on the number, or does it spread around it?
I see it directly on the number.
What about a white number on black paper?
Here is one. What do you see? It's even more clearly red than the black one. Dunno why. What about double-digit numbers? I drew a bold 75 on the pad and showed it to her. Would her brain start blending the colors, or see a totally new color? I see each number with its appropriate color, but I have often noticed this myself, unless the numbers are too close. Okay, let's try that. Here, the 7 and 5 are much closer together. What do you see? I still see them in the correct colors, but they seem to fight or cancel each other. They seem dimmer. And what if I draw the number 7 in the wrong color ink? I drew a green 7 on the pad and showed it to her. Ugh, it looks hideous. It jars, like there is something wrong with it. I certainly don't mix the real color with the mental color. I see both colors simultaneously, but it looks hideous. Susan's remark reminded me of what I had read in the older papers on synesthesia, that the experience of color was often emotionally tinged for them, and that incorrect colors could produce a strong aversion. Of course, we all experience emotions with certain colors. Blue seems calming, and red is passionate. Could it be that the same process is, for some odd reason, exaggerated in synesthetes? What can synesthesia tell us about the link between color and emotion that artists like Van Gogh and Monet have long been fascinated by? There was a hesitant knock on the door. We hadn't noticed that almost an hour had passed, and that the other student, a girl named Becky, was still outside my office. Fortunately, she was cheerful, despite having waited so long. We asked Susan to come back the following week and invited Becky in. It turned out that she, too, was a synesthete. We repeated the same questions and conducted the same tests on her as we had on Susan. Her answers were uncannily similar, with a few minor differences. Becky saw colored numbers, but hers were not the same as Susan's. For Becky, 7 was blue and 5 was green. Unlike Susan, she saw letters of the alphabet in vivid colors. Roman numerals and numbers drawn on her hand were ineffective, which suggested that, as in Susan, the colors were driven by the visual appearance of the number and not by the numerical concept. And lastly, she saw the same rainbow-like effect that Susan saw when we recited a string of random numbers. I realized then and there that we were hot on the trail of a genuine phenomenon. All my doubts were dispelled. Susan and Becky had never met each other before, and the high level of similarity between their reports couldn't possibly be a coincidence. We later learned that there's a lot of variation among synesthetes, so we were very lucky to have stumbled on two very similar cases. But even though I was convinced, we still had a lot of work to do to produce evidence strong enough to publish. People's verbal commentaries and introspective reports are notoriously unreliable. Subjects in a laboratory setting are often highly suggestible and may unconsciously pick up what you want to hear and oblige by telling you that. Furthermore, they sometimes speak ambiguously or vaguely. What was I to make of Susan's perplexing remark, "I really do see red, but I also know it's not, so I guess I must be seeing it in my mind's eye or something"? Sensation is inherently subjective and ineffable. You know what it feels like to experience the vibrant redness of a ladybug shell, for instance, but you could never describe that redness to a blind person, or even to a colorblind person who cannot distinguish red from green. And for that matter, you can never truly know whether other people's inner mental experience of redness is the same as yours. This makes it somewhat tricky, to put it mildly, to study the perception of other people. Science traffics in objective evidence, so any observations we make about people's subjective sensory experience are necessarily indirect or second-hand. I would point out, though, that subjective impressions and single-subject case studies can often provide strong clues toward designing more formal experiments. Indeed, most of the great discoveries in neurology were initially based on simple clinical testing of single cases and their subjective reports before being confirmed in other patients. One of the first patients with whom we launched a systematic study in search of hard proof of the reality of synesthesia was Francesca, a mild-mannered woman in her mid-40s who had been seeing a psychiatrist because she had been experiencing a mild low-grade depression. He prescribed lorazepam and Prozac, but not knowing what to make of her synesthetic experiences, referred her to my lab. She was the same woman I mentioned earlier, who claimed that right from very early childhood, she experienced vivid emotions when she touched different textures. But how could we test the truth of her claim? Perhaps she was just a highly emotional person and simply enjoyed speaking about the emotions that various objects triggered in her. Perhaps she was mentally disturbed and just wanted attention or to feel special. Francesca came into the lab one day, having seen an ad in the San Diego Reader. After tea and the usual pleasantries, my student David Brang and I hooked her up to our ohm meter to measure her GSR. As we saw in Chapter 2, this device measures the moment-to-moment micro-sweating produced by fluctuating levels of emotional arousal. Unlike a person who can verbally dissemble or even be subconsciously deluded about how something makes her feel, GSR is instantaneous and automatic. When we measure GSR in normal subjects who touched various mundane textures, such as corduroy or linoleum, it was clear they experienced no emotions. But Francesca was different. For the textures that she reported gave her strong emotional reactions, such as fear or anxiety or disgust, her body produced a strong GSR signal. But when she touched textures that she said gave her warm, relaxed feelings, there was no change in the electrical resistance of her skin. Since you cannot fake GSR responses, this provided strong evidence that Francesca was telling us the truth. But to be absolutely sure that Francesca was experiencing specific emotions, we used an added procedure. Again, we took her into a room and hooked her up to the ohm meter. We asked her to follow instructions on a computer screen that would tell her which of several objects that were laid out on the table in front of her she was to touch and for how long. We said she would be alone in the room since noises from our presence might interfere with the GSR monitoring. Unbeknownst to her, we had a hidden video camera behind the monitor to record all her facial expressions. The reason we did this secretively was to ensure that her expressions were genuine and spontaneous. After the experiment, we had independent student evaluators rate the magnitude and quality of the expressions on her face, such as fear or calm. Of course, we made sure that the evaluators didn't know the purpose of the experiment and didn't know what object Francesca had been touching on any given trial. Once again, we found that there was a clear correlation between Francesca's subjective ratings of various textures and her spontaneous facial expressions. It seemed quite clear, therefore, that the emotions she claimed to experience were authentic. Mirabel, an ebullient, dark-haired young lady, had been eavesdropping on a conversation I had been having with Ed Hubbard at the Espresso Roma Cafe on campus, a stone's throw away from my office. She arched her eyebrows, whether from amusement or skepticism, I couldn't tell. She came to our lab shortly thereafter to volunteer as a subject. Like Susan and Becky, every number appeared to Mirabel to be tinged with a particular color. Susan and Becky had convinced us informally that they were reporting their experience accurately and truthfully, but with Mirabel, we wanted to see if we could scare up some hard proof that she was really seeing color, as when you see an apple, rather than just experiencing a vague mental picture of color, as when you imagine an apple. This boundary between seeing and imagining has always proved elusive in neurology. Perhaps synesthesia would help resolve the distinction between them. I waved her toward a chair in my office, but she was reluctant to sit. Her eyes darted all around the room, looking at the various antique scientific instruments and fossils lying on the table and on the floor. She was like the proverbial kid in a candy store, as she crawled all around the floor, looking at a collection of fossil fishes from Brazil. Her jeans were sliding down her hips, and I tried not to gaze directly at the tattoo on her waist. Mirabelle's eyes lit up when she saw a long, polished, fossilized bone which looked a bit like a humerus, upper arm bone. I asked her to guess what it was. She tried rib, shin bone, and thigh bone. In fact, it was the baculum, penis bone, of an extinct Pleistocene walrus. This particular one had obviously been fractured in the middle and had rehealed at an angle while the animal was alive, as evidenced by a callus formation. There was also a healed, calloused tooth mark on the fracture line, suggesting the fracture had been caused by a sexual or predatory bite. There is a detective aspect to paleontology, just as there is in neurology, and we could have gone on with all this for another 2 hours. But we were running out of time. We needed to get back to her synesthesia. We began with a simple experiment. We showed Mirabelle a white number 5 on a black computer screen. As expected, she saw it in color, in her case, bright red. We had her fix her gaze on a small white dot in the middle of the screen. This is called a fixation spot. It keeps the eyes from wandering. We then gradually moved the number farther and farther away from the central spot to see if this did anything to the color that was evoked. Mirabelle pointed out that the red color became progressively less vivid as the number was moved away, eventually becoming a pale, desaturated pink. This in itself may not seem very surprising. A number seen off-axis prompts a weaker color, but it was nonetheless telling us something important. Even seen off to the side, the number itself was still perfectly identifiable, yet the color was much weaker. In one stroke, the result showed that synesthesia can't be just a childhood memory or a metaphorical association. If the number were merely evoking the memory or the idea of a color, why should it matter where it was placed in the visual field, so long as it is still clearly recognizable? We then used a second, more direct test called pop-out, which psychologists employ to determine whether an effect is truly perceptual or only conceptual. If you look at Figure 3-1, you will see a set of tilted lines scattered amid a forest of vertical lines. The tilted lines stick out like a sore thumb. They pop out. Indeed, you can not only pick them out of the crowd almost instantly, but can also group them mentally to form a separate plane or cluster. If you do this, you can easily see that the cluster of tilted lines forms the global shape of an X. Similarly, in Figure 3-2, red dots scattered among green dots, pictured here as black dots among gray dots, pop out vividly and form the global shape of a triangle. In contrast, look at Figure 3-3. You see a set of T's scattered amid the L's, but unlike the tilted lines and the colored dots of the previous two figures, the T's don't give you the same vivid, automatic, here I am pop-out effect, in spite of the fact that L's and T's are as different from each other as vertical and tilted lines. You also cannot group the T's nearly as easily, and must instead engage in an item-by-item inspection. We may conclude from this that only certain primitive or elementary perceptual features, such as color and line orientation, can provide a basis for grouping and pop-out. More complex perceptual tokens, such as graphemes, letters and numbers, cannot do so, however different they might be from each other. To take an extreme example, if I showed you a sheet of paper with the word love typed all over it and a few hates scattered about, you could not find the hates very easily. You would have to search for them in a more or less serial fashion, and even as you found them, one by one, they still wouldn't segregate from the background the way the tilted lines or colors do. Again, this is because linguistic concepts like love and hate cannot serve as a basis for grouping, however dissimilar they might be conceptually. Your ability to group and segregate similar features probably evolved mainly to defeat camouflage and discover hidden objects in the world. For instance, if a lion hides behind a mottling of green foliage, the raw image that enters your eye and hits your retina is nothing but a bunch of yellowish fragments broken up by intervals of green. However, this is not what you see. Your brain knits together the fragments of tawny fur to discern the global shape and activates your visual category for lion. And from there, it's straight on to the amygdala. Your brain treats the probability that all those yellow patches could be truly isolated and independent from each other as essentially zero. This is why a painting or a photograph of a lion hiding behind foliage, in which the patches of color actually are independent and unrelated, still makes you see the lion. Your brain automatically tries to group low-level perceptual features together to see if they add up to something important, like lions. Perceptual psychologists routinely exploit these effects to determine whether a particular visual feature is elementary. If the feature gives you pop-out and grouping, the brain must be extracting it early in sensory processing. If pop-out and grouping are muted or absent, higher-order sensory or even conceptual processing must be involved in representing the objects in question. L and T share the same elementary features in common, one short horizontal and one short vertical line touching at right angles. The main things that distinguish them in our minds are linguistic and conceptual factors. So let's get back to Mirabelle. We know that real colors can lead to grouping and pop-out. Would her private colors be able to elicit the same effects? To answer this question, I devised patterns similar to the one shown in Figure 3-4, a forest of blocky fives with a few blocky twos scattered among them. Since the fives are just mirror images of the twos, they are composed of identical features, two vertical lines and three horizontal ones. When you look at this image, you manifestly do not get pop-out. You can only spot the twos through item-by-item inspection. And you can't easily discern the global shape, the big triangle, by mentally grouping the twos. They simply don't segregate from the background. Although you can eventually deduce logically that the twos form a triangle, you don't see a big triangle the way you see the one in Figure 3-5, where the twos have been rendered in black and the fives in gray. Now, what if you were to show Figure 3-4 to a synesthete who claims to experience twos as red and fives as green? If she were merely thinking of red and green, then, just like you and me, she wouldn't instantly see the triangle. On the other hand, if synesthesia were a genuinely low-level sensory effect, she might literally see the triangle the way you and I do in Figure 3-5. For this experiment, we first showed images much like Figure 3-4 to 20 normal students and told them to look for a global shape made of little twos among the clutter. Some of the figures contained a triangle, others showed a circle. We flashed these figures in a random sequence on a computer monitor for about half a second each, too short a time for detailed visual inspection. After seeing each figure, the subjects had to press one of two buttons to indicate whether they had just been shown a circle or a triangle. Not surprisingly, the students' hit rate was about 50%. In other words, they were just guessing, since they couldn't spontaneously discern the shape. But if we colored all the fives green and all the twos red, in Figure 3-5, this is simulated with gray and black, their performance went up to 80 or 90%. They could now see the shape instantly, without a pause or a thought. The surprise came when we showed the black and white displays to Mirabelle. Unlike the non-synesthetes, she was able to identify the shape correctly on 80 to 90% of trials, just as if the numbers were actually colored differently. The synesthetically induced colors were just as effective as real colors in allowing her to discover and report the global shape. This experiment provides unassailable proof that Mirabelle's induced colors are genuinely sensory. There is simply no way she could fake it, and no way it could be the result of childhood memories or any of the other alternative explanations that have been proposed.
Ed and I realized that for the first time since Francis Galton, we had clear, unambiguous proof from our experiments, grouping and pop-out, that synesthesia was indeed a real sensory phenomenon, proof that had eluded researchers for over a century. Indeed, our displays could not only be used to distinguish fakes from genuine synesthetes, but also to ferret out closet synesthetes, people who might have the ability but not realize it, or not be willing to admit it. Ed and I sat back in the cafe, discussing our findings. Between our experiments with Francesca and Mirabel, we had established that synesthesia exists. The next question was, why does it exist? Could a glitch in brain wiring explain it? What did we know that could help us figure this out? First, we knew that the most common type of synesthesia is apparently number color. Second, we knew that one of the main color centers in the brain is an area called V4 in the fusiform gyrus of the temporal lobes. V4 was discovered by Semir Zeki, professor of neuroaesthetics at University College of London and a world authority on the organization of the primate visual system. Third, we knew that there may be areas in roughly the same part of the brain that are specialized for numbers. We know this because small lesions to this part of the brain cause patients to lose arithmetic skills. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if number-color synesthesia were simply caused by some accidental cross-wiring between the number and color centers in the brain? This seemed almost too obvious to be true. But why not? I suggested we look at some brain atlases to see exactly how close these two areas really are in relation to each other. Hey, maybe we can ask Tim, Ed responded. He was referring to Tim Rickard, a colleague of ours at the center. Tim had used sophisticated brain imaging techniques like fMRI to map out the brain area where visual number recognition occurs. Later that afternoon, Ed and I compared the exact location of V4 and the number area in an atlas of the human brain. To our amazement, we saw that the number area and V4 were right next to each other in the fusiform gyrus, figure 3-6. This was strong support for the cross-wiring hypothesis. Can it really be a coincidence that the most common type of synesthesia is the number-color type, and the number and color areas are immediate neighbors in the brain? This was starting to look too much like 19th century phrenology, but maybe it was true. Since the 19th century, a debate has raged between phrenology, the notion that different functions are sharply localized in different brain areas, versus holism, which holds that functions are emergent properties of the entire brain whose parts are in constant interaction. It turns out this is an artificial polarization to some degree because the answer depends on the particular function one is talking about. It would be ludicrous to say that gambling or cooking are localized, although there may be aspects of them that are, but it would be equally silly to say that the cough reflex or the pupil's reflex to light is not localized. What's surprising, though, is that even some non-stereotyped functions, such as seeing colors or numbers, as shapes or even numerical ideas, are in fact mediated by specialized brain regions. Even high-level perceptions, such as tools or vegetables or fruits, which border on being concepts rather than mere perceptions, can be lost selectively depending on the particular small region of the brain that is damaged by stroke or accident. So what do we know about brain localization? How many specialized regions are there, and how are they arranged? Just as the CEO of a corporation delegates different tasks to different people occupying different offices, your brain parcels out different jobs to different regions. The process begins when neural signals from your retina travel to an area in the back of your brain where the image gets categorized into different simple attributes, such as color, motion, form, and depth. After that, information about separate features gets divvied up and distributed to several far-flung regions in your temporal and parietal lobes. For example,
information about the direction of moving targets goes to V5 in your parietal lobes. Color information gets sent mainly to V4 in your temporal lobes. The reason for this division of labor is not hard to divine. The kinds of computation you need for extracting information about wavelength, color, is very different from the computations required for extracting information about motion. It may be simpler to accomplish this if you have separate areas for each task, keeping the neural machinery distinct for economy of wiring and ease of computation. It also makes sense to organize specialized regions into hierarchies. In a hierarchical system, each higher level carries out more sophisticated tasks, but just like in a corporation, there is an enormous amount of feedback and crosstalk. For example, color information processed in V4 gets relayed to higher color areas that lie farther up in the temporal lobes near the angular gyrus. These higher areas may be concerned with more complex aspects of color processing. The eucalyptus leaves I see all over campus appear to be the same shade of green at dusk as they do midday, even though the wavelength composition of light reflected is very different in the two cases. Light at dusk is red, but you don't suddenly see leaves as reddish-green. They still look green because your higher color areas compensate. Numerical computation, too, seems to occur in stages. An early stage in the fusiform gyrus, where the actual shapes of numbers are represented, and a later stage in the angular gyrus, concerned with numerical concepts such as ordinality, sequence, and cardinality, quantity. When the angular gyrus is damaged by a stroke or a tumor, a patient may still be able to identify numbers, but can no longer divide or subtract. Multiplication often survives because it is learned by rote. It was this aspect of brain anatomy, the close proximity of colors and numbers in the brain, in both the fusiform gyrus and near the angular gyrus, that made me suspect that number-color synesthesia was caused by crosstalk between these specialized brain areas. But if such neural cross-wiring is the correct explanation, why does it occur at all? Galton observed that synesthesia runs in families, a finding that has been repeatedly confirmed by other researchers. Thus, it is fair to ask whether there is a genetic basis for synesthesia. Perhaps synesthetes harbor a mutation that causes some abnormal connections to exist between adjacent brain areas that are normally well segregated from each other. If this mutation is useless or deleterious, why hasn't it been weeded out by natural selection? Furthermore, if the mutation were to be expressed in a patchy manner, it might explain why some synesthetes crosswire colors and numbers, whereas others, like a synesthete I once saw named Esmeralda, see colors in response to musical notes. Consistent with Esmeralda's case, hearing centers in the temporal lobes are close to the brain areas that receive color signals from V4 and higher color centers. I felt the pieces were starting to fall into place. The fact that we see various types of synesthesia provides additional evidence for cross-wiring. Perhaps the mutant gene expresses itself to a greater degree in more brain regions in some synesthetes than in others. But how exactly does the mutation cause cross-wiring? We know that the normal brain does not come ready-made with neatly packaged areas that are clearly delineated from each other. In the fetus, there is an initial dense over-proliferation of connections that get pruned back as development proceeds. One reason for this extensive pruning process is presumably to avoid leakage, signal spread, between adjacent areas, just as Michelangelo whittled away excess marble to produce David. This pruning is largely under genetic control. It's possible that the synesthesia mutation leads to incomplete pruning between some areas that lie close to each other. The net result would be the same, cross-wiring. However, it is important to note that anatomical cross-wiring between brain areas cannot be the complete explanation for synesthesia. If it were,
How could you account for the commonly reported emergence of synesthesia during the use of hallucinogenic drugs such as LSD? A drug can't suddenly induce sprouting of new axon connections, and such connections would not magically vanish after the drug wore off. Thus, it must be enhancing the activity of pre-existing connections in some way, which is not inconsistent with the possibility that synesthetes have more of these connections than the rest of us. David Brang and I also encountered two synesthetes who temporarily lost their synesthesia when they started taking antidepressant drugs called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, a drug family that famously includes Prozac.